On Wednesday, June 21st, The Washington Post hosted the second of its Addiction in America live interview series, which convenes policymakers, researchers, and healthcare experts to examine the country's opioid crisis. In this segment, Addiction Crisis, A Nation Responds, congressional reporter Mike DeBonis talks with Democratic Senator Ed Markey from Massachusetts, Greg Walden, who chairs the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and Congresswoman Diana DeGette, Chief Deputy Whip of the House Democratic Caucus. The panel discussed how Congress is responding to the opioid epidemic, what bipartisan action could come from Capitol Hill, and potential regulation we could see from the states. Let's listen.
I invite you all to sit down now. So joining me on stage, and pardon me just a moment while I adjust this. First off, we have Congresswoman Diana DeGette of Colorado. She's a senior Democrat on the House Energy and Commerce Committee. She's the ranking Democrat on the Oversight Investigation Subcommittee. She co-authored the 20th Century Cures Act, which put $1 billion of new federal funds into the opioid epidemic to combat it. She's also the chief deputy whip of the Democratic House Democratic Caucus. Thank you very much, Congresswoman. Senator Ed Markey is here of Massachusetts, Democrat, and a member of the Senate Commerce Committee, which has broad jurisdiction over private industry, including the pharmaceutical industry. He's done numerous investigations and authored numerous pieces of legislation to address this crisis. He's going to talk quite a bit about that. And last but not least, Chairman Greg Walden is with us today of Oregon, Republican of Oregon. He has drawn attention to the opioid epidemic as it's affected his district in rural eastern Oregon. He plays a key role in overseeing the health sector of our economy. He played a key role in drafting the American Health Care Act, which is now going through the congressional process. And we're going to give you an opportunity to talk about that legislation and the oversight that you've done on your committee. Thank you very much for being here. Let me start with Senator Markey. And this is a question I'm going to throw to everybody on the panel today. But tell me how you first experienced this crisis as a crisis. When did you understand that this is something that needed your attention? And what did you see in your state that compelled you to act?
It was Taunton, Massachusetts. It was Martin Luther King Day, January 15th, 2014. I was standing in the back of the room getting ready to give my speech, and I said to the police chief and the mayor, Mayor Hoy in Taunton, what's the biggest issue? And they said, well, we've lost 7 people to overdoses in just the last couple of weeks. And then I said to the chief, I said, well, what's the issue? And he said, well, they're now lacing the heroin with fentanyl. Then he explained to me about fentanyl. And I brought back Gil Kerlikowske, the drug czar for the United States, the next month into Taunton. And the numbers are huge. In Massachusetts, in 2016, we lost 2,000 people to overdose deaths, opioid-related deaths. We're only 2% of America's population. If the whole country was dying at our rate, that would be 100,000 people in a year. That would be 2 Vietnam Wars every single year. Of those who died, the 2,000, 70% had fentanyl in their system. That would be 1,400 people in Massachusetts last year. You extrapolate that out for the whole country, that would be 70,000 people dying from fentanyl-related overdoses in 1 year. That is now something that is going to hit the rest of the country slowly but surely. Massachusetts is a preview of coming attractions. Only 33,000 people died from opioid overdoses in the whole country last year. We're 3 times worse than the national rate. But unless we put in place the prevention and treatment programs, we are going to see this epidemic just explode even further. And from that moment in Taunton, when the police chief and the mayor told me about fentanyl. It has been just a predictor of this catastrophe spreading inevitably across the country.
And what year was that, Senator?
January of 2014. So it was 14, 15, 16. We're now halfway through 2017. And the numbers have skyrocketed since 2014 in Massachusetts, as they have across the whole country.
And to just put in a plug for my distinguished colleagues, if you pick up a copy of today's Washington Post, there's a story in there with an amazing statistic that illustrates the scope of this issue, that in 2014 you had nearly 1.3 million emergency room visits or inpatient stays for opioid-related issues in 2014. That's a 99% jump for emergency room treatment compared to 2005.
Yeah.
It's a remarkable statistic.
And by the way, that 2014 number, that's a great story on the front in the Washington Post today, that number is much, much higher today in Massachusetts, and we were the second worst state on that list in the study that the Post had today, and we have a much worse problem today than we had in 2014.
Chairman Walden, let me ask you, you represent Eastern Oregon, it's a rural community, largely rural, some of the most beautiful country in America. But what's happening there? What have you seen? And what was the moment when you realized there was something that needed to be done?
Well, I've done a series of roundtables a couple of years ago, and I always remember just a couple of examples. There was a woman in Hermiston, Oregon, rural eastern Oregon, who talked about her addiction to opioids. She's now a treatment counselor, but trying to get off of it was almost impossible. She wanted to get on to Suboxone, I think, that helps you get off of it. There was no physician in the immediate area that could help her, so she would commute 5.5 hours each way into Washington State where she could get treatment and finally get off. And then down in Southern Oregon, in Medford, I did a roundtable with law enforcement, addiction specialists, hospital people, and family. And this fellow was sitting in the back. He wasn't actually part of the roundtable. But I called on him and said, what brings you here? He said, my son was an athlete in high school and got injured and got prescribed opioids to deal with the pain, and tragically got hooked and went to the cheaper, more potent version of that. You would know it as heroin. And he said he succumbed to that. He said, my sister was a nurse. Same sort of scenario. She got hooked on it. She would write her own prescriptions, forging the doctor's prescription pad, got caught, moved on somewhere else, took it up again. The addiction overwhelmed her, and she too had died. And then you begin to talk to everybody else in your communities, how they're affected. And this addiction explosion has been going on now in Oregon. We're ninth in the country, fourth for among women. But we predate that with the other scourge, which was methamphetamine, and the cooking and all that. And Oregon really led in this. We did work here in Washington on it, like we're doing on opioids, to get the precursor chemicals out. Oh, that still remains a big issue in eastern Oregon. One of the leaders in trying to push back on this, Dr. Chuck Hoffman, who's a friend of mine, he was quoted recently in a news series about how he was trained as a physician to prescribe opioids to relieve pain. They were never really trained in alternative pain relief practices. And now it's just write the pills. Mm-hmm. And so he's trying, as a physician, leading an effort to turn this around. We're also seeing a dramatic increase, by the way, in 65 and older that are being treated as inpatients in hospitals because of this addiction. So it's affecting every age group. And finally, I would say there was a really troubling story as part of this series the Argus Observer ran about a physician who engages in the treatment, and one of his patients is a rancher who keeps preloaded syringes in the cab of his tractor, so when he's out there, he can just shoot up during the day, and they're loaded with heroin. And so, I mean, this is having unbelievable consequence across our country. And I think we're all together in trying to figure out strategies to reduce the illegal pills in the market, and to, you know, we passed legislation to reduce the prescription amounts that have to be given. I mean, there's a lot we can do.
Congressman, let me ask you this. You represent a different kind of district. You represent a good part of Denver and its suburbs. It's an urban and suburban district. So much of the reporting on this has talked about this as a rural phenomenon in communities like in Eastern Oregon. Is that the whole picture, or is that not the whole picture?
Oh, no. I mean, this opioid problem, it pervades. I think people focus on rural areas because they expect that drug and addiction issues will be urban issues, so they're shocked when it's in rural Oregon. But I remember you were asking my colleagues, when did this hit home? A couple of years ago, I was at the Book Lovers Ball, which is the annual fundraiser for the Denver Public Library. And I was sitting next to the Denver Public Librarian, and I said, what are the issues you're facing here at the Denver Public Library? And I thought she would say something like, you know, cybersecurity or access to books. She said, you know, we have people overdosing in the library every day, and we need to get our librarians naloxone so that they can give it to people who have overdosed at the Denver Public Library. And so, now there was just a story the other day in the Denver Post that they finally did get the librarians naloxone, but they actually had a guy die in the main library last year. They've had a number of overdoses, and the librarians just open up their desks and run over. I mean, imagine that. And I think what all three of us have recognized is this really does seem to have exploded on the scene. We've heard stories about addiction for some years and cautions about overuse of opioids, but these stories are just exploding. And in our committee, the Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee of Energy and Commerce, we did a whole series of hearings about a year or two ago on opioids. And it was amazing how many misconceptions there were about the extent and the nature of the problem, and how much confusion there was about what you do about it. Mm-hmm. And so it's not always that you have hearings that really educate the members of Congress, but I think we all learned a lot about what we need to be doing. And of course, that was part of what informed the CARA bill last summer that we passed, and then the funding that you mentioned that Fred Upton and I put in our 21st Century Cures.
So let's talk about Cures briefly. That was a really remarkable bill, not only for what was in it, but the fact that it came together at all at a time when the parties weren't last year and still aren't working together on a whole lot in a productive manner. But this was one area where Republicans and Democrats came together. You work with Fred Upton, the Chairman Walden's predecessor on energy and commerce, to make this happen. And talk specifically about the addiction part of that bill and how that got brought into this bill that was also about so much more, including, pharmaceutical development and things like that.
Well, I mean, this was a bill that we worked on for about 3 years, and it wasn't just me and Fred. It was also Greg, and it was Ed and his Democratic and Republican colleagues in the Senate. So it was really an effort to focus on primarily on research at the NIH and the FDA, but as the bill moved into its final stages, we realized that there were some funding issues in the healthcare space where we could really get bipartisan, bicameral consensus. Mm-hmm. And as I said, we had passed that CARA bill the year before. Mm-hmm. It had a lot of really good administrative programs for opioid prevention and treatment, but it had no money. And that was one of the biggest criticisms everybody had at that time. And so when we did the Cures bill, we were able to then say, you know, let's really put some oomph here. Let's put $1 billion in grants for state governments.
Right. Mr. Chairman, let me ask you this. Talk about, pardon me for putting it in these terms, but it can be difficult for Republicans, especially House Republicans, to spend money on anything sometimes. But this issue was one where there was a wide agreement that something had to be done. Talk about what the feeling has been with among your Republican colleagues in trying to come together.
Yeah, I would suggest too that in 21st Century Cures, we did mandatory spending for NIH because we believe in medical research, and really the big increases in NIH's budget go clear back to the days of Newt Gingrich, who believed in investing in medical research. And we doubling the NIH budget. We did that. Then there was kind of a pause. Now we're trying to ramp it back in a bigger direction. And clearly, Diana's work and Fred's and others, Tim Murphy and others, really passionate about this. These issues don't pick parties when they show up on your doorstep. And I think they help bring us all together in common cause. And so the $1 billion in my state, we just got $65 million in grants out of that. So in pretty short order, I would argue that money not only got in there, but now is getting out onto the ground, into the field, hopefully into the hands of those professionals in our communities who know best what to do with it to address this issue. So I think there were really good mechanical pieces, to Diana's point, in terms of changing how many people a physician could treat with Suboxone. Gets at that my friend from Hermiston who had to go out of state to get treatment. Now they can treat more people. You don't have to fulfill the prescription. That gets excess pills out of the market, hopefully. These are all things I learned in the roundtables I did back home, and then getting the money in there. And in the AHCA, we put another $15 billion toward this. Addiction and other things,
right.
But certainly in there we'll see, because it's not always about the money, it's about changing behaviors and finding best practices. I think that was part of the debate I heard, at least, was better understanding the physician prescribing community about what they should do, what they shouldn't do, because it kind of goes back to an original study that said, oh, there's no addictive nature to this, right. So feel free. If you go back, the foundation for where we are today was built, I think, on a false premise that it was okay that these pills wouldn't be addictive. And so
right.
Now we know 90 days is danger zone.
Yeah.
And so we need to do this education.
Right. It turns out it wasn't even a study. It was a very short letter in
right.
the New England Journal of Medicine that is sort of the pharmaceutical yeah. industry used as an explanation for prescribing these drugs. Senator, let me ask you this. There continue to be bipartisan efforts to address this. Can you talk about what you're working on right now, the Interdict Act and other efforts in the oversight realm as well to take action?
Well, I'm working with Marco Rubio on a bill to give Customs and Border Patrol the technologies they need in order to detect fentanyl and other substances at our border so that before it comes in from Mexico or from China, they're able to do that. I actually said to Mitch McConnell 2 years ago that Lexington, Kentucky, Lexington, Massachusetts doesn't make any difference. We need a Surgeon General's report on addiction, and so what I suggested to him was the smoking report, the Surgeon General's report in 1964 was a seminal moment. Mitch, you and I, we should ask the Surgeon General to do it. And he completed it in 1 year, okay, which laid out now the parameters of the problem and what needs to be done. To that extent, there is a lot of bipartisanship. I was able to pass legislation with Rand Paul on Suboxone, on medication-assisted therapy, so that became a part of the law as well. On the other hand, we're having a big battle right now about funding in the Affordable Care Act and whether or not the slashing of that funding is going to have a profound effect upon the ability for people to gain access to the treatment which they need. The Centers for American Progress have concluded that $91 billion under the Affordable Care Act would have been spent on substance use disorders over the next 10 years. And that money will not be there if the Affordable Care Act is repealed. And so we're going to have a huge debate over whether or not, you know, this funding is going to be there, because honestly, a vision without funding is an hallucination.
You know, you've got to have the funding there in order to provide these programs. And this debate is now really escalating in the Senate because we, the Democrats, are saying that that this opioid epidemic, this substance use disorder epidemic, is something that is going to get seriously shortchanged if the proposal, as it is currently constructed, becomes the law in our country.
Well, let me throw it to Chairman Walden. As chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, you know more than anybody else in the Capitol about what's in the American Health Care Act, which is the Republican health care bill that's now moving through the process. That is not a bipartisan effort, as we all know. This is the Republican response to the Affordable Care Act. You've heard folks like Senator Markey and even some people in your own party on the Senate side talk about the potentially difficult effects this bill could have on the addiction treatment. Right. Can you give us some facts as you see them of what this bill would do and what's in that bill to help folks who are suffering from addiction?
Yeah, thank you. First of all, you have to sort of bifurcate it, because what we do know is the individual insurance market has a lot of problems on the exchanges. And so you have a group of people who we want to make sure have insurance or access to choices in insurance, affordable insurance. And right now, state after state, county after county, we're seeing more and more limited choices. Some counties may have no choice. So if you're in need of treatment and you can't get insurance, you have really no options or very few options. So we're trying to fix that insurance market. This is difficult work to do. It's difficult in the House. It's difficult in the Senate, because we share a common goal of trying to make coverage available, make it affordable. On the other hand, on the Medicaid side, we believe that there's enough headroom in there, in the about $90 billion that's there, that we put in under a provision to allow increased deductibility of health insurance costs. It was really just to move about $90 billion to make it more flexible for the Senate to make some changes. Mm-hmm. We put specifically $15 billion in for addiction treatment and some other related causes, in addition to the flexibility of the Patient, State, and Stability Fund, which gives states great flexibility to use the money either to bolster their insurance markets and or use it for other purposes, which could be addiction. So I think there's a lot there, and it's not always about the money. And remember, early on I said that in my state we're seeing an enormous percentage uptick in people that are 65 and older. Most likely they're on Medicare, not Medicaid. That's a problem area as well that needs help. So, I mean, what we have to do is get to the root cause. You have to get to the prescription issues. You have to get to the treatment issues. I understand. But we think there's room there to do that.
Congresswoman DeGette, I imagine you might have a differing perspective.
I agree. Money's not always the panacea, but the problem is that if people don't have insurance to pay for their treatment, then they can't get the treatment no matter what funds you set up or whatever else. And according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, under the House proposal, 23 million people will lose their insurance, even after all these funds were added at the 11th hour on the floor. And so when you have 23 million people who are either on the Medicaid expansion or are going to lose their insurance because their premium support is reduced or whatever it is, if they can't get access to mental health treatment programs because they don't have insurance, then it doesn't do any good. And that's why many, many commentators in the mental health space say that the AHCA would be very, very, it would be a huge backward step for opioid treatment, because people just simply wouldn't be able to get access to those programs. And frankly, as much as I love my former Energy and Commerce colleague, Ed Markey, I don't ever legislate in the hopes that the Senate to say, well, you know, okay, this is a problem with this bill, but I know it'll be fixed over in the Senate. I think we should get it right the first time. And I'm really concerned right now, frankly, that maybe Ed can talk about this, that Mitch McConnell saying he's going to bring up some bill. Not only have the Democrats not seen it, most of the Republicans haven't seen it either. We have no idea what that bill is going to do in terms of access to Medicaid in the states or to premium support or anything else.
And you know, and Diana is right. The only thing more secret than this Republican health care bill in the Senate are Donald Trump's tax returns. Okay, we have no idea what's in it. The public has no idea what's in it. It's being put together in secret. We know it could have a profound impact on substance use disorder treatment. And so the consequences for public health in our country are profound. And right now, this is a process that has not allowed for any public input, any Democratic bipartisan input, just the opposite of the way in which the Cures Act and CARA were put together.
Let me ask Chairman Wallen to jump back in here. You've got Republican colleagues in the Senate, people like Rob Portman, Shelley right. Moore Capito, who have been very outspoken right. on the effect of this crisis on their states. Are you confident that they're not going to vote for a bill that they think is going to harm their constituents in this way?
Well, first of all, I'm not going to speak for any senator, let alone Senator Portman. They can speak for themselves how they're going to vote or anything else. I do know they care deeply about these issues. I do know that throughout the discussions in the House, I made a couple of presentations at the Senate Republican Conference. None of this was a secret within our world in terms of moving things back and forth. And I mean, the legislative process is built upon give and take between the House and the Senate and understandings and flexibility. I'm sure that's how we got to 21st Century Cures. It's how we got to CARA. It's how we get to major legislation. There's always give and take between the Senate, and there's communication between the Senate. Reconciliation traditionally is pretty partisan process by both sides, used by both sides. As you know, when the Affordable Care Act was first fully implemented, the final bill, we weren't allowed a single amendment on the House floor because it couldn't be changed, because in my friend's state, Senator Kennedy passed away and was replaced by Scott Brown. They couldn't allow a single word to be changed, so we had no amendment capability, and then they chased it with reconciliation to try and clear up the mess. And that's the law we have today, and it's crashing around the country when it comes to the individual insurance markets. You've got five states that may be down to one or no options, multiple counties. Premiums have not gone down $2,500. They've gone up. And the CBO scores has consistently been wrong based on the principle they put on, or the power they put on, the individual mandate is going to force people to buy insurance. They've been off 2-1 in their estimates in 2016, in their estimates in 2017. I mean, they get it wrong. They've got a tough job, but their numbers are off. We're trying to rescue that market so people have access to affordable insurance. And by the way, if you're not in that subsidized pool, I met with a woman the other day, $600 a month in premium, $16,000 in deductible. That's hardly insurance. So you've got a whole group of people out there that are suffering today, and we're trying to fix that market so it'll work in the future and people can get access to coverage.
I'll just say, you know, obviously there's a partisan divide on this bill that we're not going to overcome today on this stage. I did want to, in our last few couple minutes here, ask about another part of this. We've talked about this from the industry perspective, the public health perspective, the oversight perspective. This is also a criminal issue that the people are breaking the law here. Senator Mark, you talked about fentanyl and the very serious problem that very potent opioid has created. We have a proposal on the table now from Senator Grassley and Senator Feinstein, bipartisan proposal, to give the federal prosecutors, the Justice Department, more powers to take action in that regard. Have you had a chance to look at that legislation? Is that something that you're able to support, or is there another way to go about it?
We have to crack down on the really bad actors, that is, these drug cartels coming in from Mexico, what China is doing. We have to elevate this importation of fentanyl up to the same level as nuclear nonproliferation and copyright protection in our discussions with the Chinese. That's the level. That's the terrorist threat on the streets of America. There's no two ways about it. That's how the American people see it. But let's be honest, we owe
an apology to an entire generation of African-American young men who we incarcerated as part of the crack cocaine epidemic in the 1990s. So let's not think again that we can incarcerate our way out of this problem. We can only provide treatment to get out of this problem. And while there might be some targeted law enforcement measures that we can all come together to support, the overriding issue is providing the funding, the access to treatment and prevention for families in our country.
Mr. Chairman, what are you hearing from the law enforcement in your district, and what other tools do you think they need?
There are some communication issues that we need to carefully think through between law enforcement and the prescribing community. How do you manage patient privacy in that realm? You know, when law enforcement picks somebody up, what are they on? How do you treat them? Is there some communication issues there? And I think it really gets back to who's issuing the prescription in the first place, and are they getting the proper consultation and best practices? Because that's where it starts. We have this other issue, and I concur, we have to deal with in terms of treatment for people who are hooked. But we're now making some progress. We're, instead of issuing a 90-day prescription, it's 21. There's fewer pills out there. And we're investigating, you know, when I will, the fentanyl issue. Mm-hmm. We're investigating the issue in West Virginia. How does a community with a few hundred people have 100 million pills going into it? I mean, we're doing a lot of that sort of work as well. I commend the Chinese for the steps they have taken, but obviously there's more to take to reduce access. And let's look at the Postal Service. Most of this stuff's coming in through the U.S. Postal Service because they don't have the tools to adequately screen it out. So we've got some of this on our own hands here that we have to do more work on, and we're going to be investigating all those through the oversight investigation.
Congresswoman, I'm going to give you the last word.
Well, I'll just end on a collegial note here, is that what both my colleagues said is really true. We need so much more coordination, understanding of the problem, coordination with the whole system, the prescription system, the law enforcement system. We didn't have that before. We also need to have a medical understanding of how these opioids work and what the best treatment is. In Colorado, we have a consortium that has formed. I just met with them the other day, and they're looking at this holistic approach. How do we work on controlling how these opioids are prescribed? How do we prevent people and educate doctors and patients? And then how do we work at it from the law enforcement perspective? And then how do we help people who have become addicted? I think more and more people realize that holistic approach is really the approach that's going to work. And in Congress, what we need to figure out is both how to get the funding for that and also how to get the programs that work.
I want to end up,
quick.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really important. We also should not overreact. These drugs are very important in pain management when administered appropriately. Right. And so we have to understand there are a lot of people managing pain effectively with opiates. We have to make sure that we don't overreact and hurt them along the way by accident. So it's a balance.
Okay. Thank you very much, Congresswoman Diana DeGette, Senator Ed Markey, and Chairman Greg Walden. And thank you all. We'll have more panels for you very shortly. You'll be in very good hands with my colleague, Lainey Bernstein. Thank you very much.
Beautiful.
Thanks for listening. To hear more interviews from this series and other Washington Post Live programs, visit us at WashingtonPostLive.com.